From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Vermont author Brad Kessler, whose 2021 novel, North, was shortlisted for the Vermont Book Award. He is the author of two other critically acclaimed novels, Lick Creek and Birds in Fall, which was a recipient of the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, and a memoir, Goat Song. He has been awarded a Whiting, a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, and the Rome Prize from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. His work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Nation, The Kenyon Review, and BOM. Here's a little information about his novel, North. As a late spring blizzard brews, Brother Christopher, a cloistered monk at Blue Mountain Monastery in Vermont, rushes to tend to his Ida Red and Northern Spy apple trees in advance of the unseasonal snowstorm. When the storm lands a young Somali refugee, Saro Abdi Muse, at the monastery, Christopher is pulled back into the world as his life intersects with Saro's and that of an Afghan war veteran in surprising and revealing ways. North traces the epic journey of Saro from her home in Somalia to South America along the migrant route through Central America and Mexico to New York City and finally her dangerous attempt to continue north to safety in Canada. It also traces the inner journeys of Brother Christopher questioning his future in a world where the monastery way of life is waning, and of veteran Teddy Fletcher seeking a way to make peace with his past. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Brad Kessler. I do want to know how North began for you, because it's a beautiful story. There's such a lot going on, so I just wondered how it began for you.
Well, this book had a long gestation. It took over 10 years from the first conception to writing it through and putting it down and getting back to it. But the first impulse, I think, came with the idea that my wife and I had moved here to this little valley in Vermont in 1998 after searching for years for a place in rural America, and particularly the mountains. And we're both kids who grew up in the suburb, different suburbs, Long Island and New York City. And we had lived in West Virginia for a little while and learned how to kind of live rurally and on a farm and grow our own food and do that kind of thing. But we didn't want to live in West Virginia for various reasons and couldn't find a place. So we'd spent years looking for a home, looking for a house, like a rural retreat. And a place to live and again, feed ourselves. And so that happened, and we started raising goats, and I wrote a book about it. And so this idea, fast forward 10 years later, and we're living in this little valley in Vermont, and our neighbors are monks, the Carthusian, the Charter House of the Transfiguration, which is the only Carthusian monastery in the U.S. And they're a very old order. It goes back to this guy, St. Bruno, and they have, vows of silence, very strict order. They don't allow guests up there. And they're literally our neighbors. We hear their bells sometimes at Vespers if the cloud covers just right. And so, and I would walk up there occasionally and spy on them, not exactly spy on them, just walk through their lands. I mean, it's open, but they don't welcome strangers, but I'm a neighbor. So sometimes I would have a nice conversation with a monk, and they do, even though they have vows of silence, they're allowed to talk. So, I just found there was an interesting parallel between what we were doing here in terms of fencing off our land for our goats and making this little Edenic pasture where we were, an enclosure essentially, and what the monks did up there, which is, they live inside of what's called an enclosure, and within that enclosure they sort of contemplate and pray for the world. I mean, that's the essential mission of all monks, that they're praying for the world, even though they isolate themselves from the world to pray for the world. So I that idea just you know, really struck, has always struck a chord in me. And since moving here, this idea of fencing in this land made me think about, certainly in 2012, when I started writing this book, made me think about, all right, so we're fencing in this land, and who are we leaving out? Who are we fencing out? And so all that was happening around 2012 with the Syrian war and the immigration crisis from Africa. And so, and my wife's a photographer, and she was working with this woman who works for Physicians for Human Rights, photographing asylum seekers who's from the asylum seeker whose cases had been denied. And so I was very aware of what was going on through her and through Joanne, Dr. Ahola. I was very aware of what was going on in terms of asylum and how difficult it was back. This is the Obama years, and what was happening at the border during the Obama years. And so it was very much on my radar. And so I wanted to kind of write about these two worlds. One is where we lived, which is full of these monasteries. Where I live, on the, it's right on the border of New York State and southwestern Vermont. And we have the Carthusians next door, and we have down the road, we have the monks of Newskeet, who are, you know, ostensibly Russian Orthodox, although I don't think they really have followed that line.
I just know them from the dog training.
Yeah, they do the raising, the art of raising a puppy, and so they're 20 minutes down the road, and they're more open to the public. We used to sing with some of their members in the local choir in the Baton Kilke Chorale, and then even further down the road in I think Greenwich, New York, is the Sisters of St. Mary's on the Hill that my wife became involved with photographing and working with them. So there, this place is like lousy with monks and nuns. And then also the Weston Priory, which is up, you know, maybe about an hour away up in the Green Mountains. So this idea that people came to this area, the North Country, for a rural retreat or for sanctuary, for asylum, I wanted to kind of parallel that with people who were seeking political asylum or real asylum, that were fleeing terrible conditions in, you know, war, civil war, famine, in the rest of the world, and how, and sort of play those two off each other, and as an examination of sanctuary in general, and how we think of this country as, you know, the lighthouse and, an asylum for the multitudes, and how that message, even in the Obama years, was kind of ringing a little hollow. And then, so when I started writing this, I thought it was going to be a book that was going to take place in a dystopic future. So it was 2012, 13, 14, you know, and then the dystopic future arrived. In 2016, I think. And so by the time of the election of Trump and the Muslim ban and the closing of the borders to immigrants, it was no longer a novel that took place in the future. It was a novel that was taking place in the present, to my chagrin. And I think to other people's, you know, other people were affected much more deeply than my little project here. So, but then in the end, the novel got published. It was a novel that took place not in the present and not in the past, but in the continual, maybe the continual present, because I mean, Biden, by that point, Biden was the president when it came out in 2000, and this book came out in 2021, I think. So it had gone through this whole cycle. And by that point, the immigration and the crisis at the border and this back route through that people were taking through Central America and Mexico. By that point, it was common. People knew about it. It had been on the news. And back, you know, when I started this, it was, you know, an open secret that people knew, you know, people in Vermont knew it. The Somali community in Burlington knew about this back route, which is that people would come from the Horn of Africa or deeper in Africa. People would come from the Middle East. People would come from Asia and fly to South America and make this long, arduous, kind of an epic journey from South America through the dangerous Darien Gap in the Panama and through all of the Central American countries and then up through Mexico. And so after this epic journey that would take, in some cases, you know, a year or longer, depending on how many times you were stopped and put in jail and how you had to make money or get money from your homeland. You know, these stories that seem to me so heroic in a way, like somebody would do this, risk their life for, you know, for just the idea of showing up at the U.S. border in Mexico. It was like, why weren't people telling that story? And so it's a story that happens to one of the characters in North, and it happens to Sorrow, and she ends up at the border right at the time where, after all that heartbreak and what she's lost to get there, and you know, then the money, she's denied asylum when she gets there, and that was very much the experience of a lot of people that were making that journey back then. Yeah. So that's a long way of giving you the background.
That's really interesting. And the fact that you had the monasteries around you, and that was sort of living in, I'm sure, your creative self as well as your actual life. That's wonderful that you were able to find a way to kind of interweave those stories. I sometimes in these interviews, I read from the book. Do you mind if I do that, if I read a couple pages?
No, go ahead.
Okay, great. I just love your prose. This is from early in the book. And it's from the perspective of Father Christopher, who in some ways is your main character. You have a couple of main characters. You have a few sort of primary characters, but Father Christopher is the abbot at the monastery. Father Christopher walked the empty cloister in the dark. The office of vigils didn't begin for another 40 minutes, but he hadn't slept all night. With all the howling wind, the electricity cutting in and out, the generator kicking on and off, he had tossed and turned throughout the storm. When the worst seemed over, he'd gotten out of bed and wandered the cloister, checking doors and windows, the library and scriptorium, the chapter hall and kitchen, making sure everything was closed up and sealed up tight. Now at 4 a.m., he entered the unlit church, the only light the red glow from the sanctuary lamp flickering in its glass flew. He made his way to the choir stall and sat in the abbot's seat. Snow ghosted dimly outside the tall altar window. The shadowy church looked clean and spare in the dark. The waxed wooden floors, the orthogonal timbers of interlocking spruce. Christopher liked arriving before the others to prayer office and sitting alone in the empty space. It gave him time to close his eyes and collect himself. The office of vigils held a special place for him and the monks of Blue Mountain. Their order had been charged for centuries with the task of waking before dawn and keeping watch through the dark for the new world to come. Seeing through the dark was part of their vocation, though lately Christopher had found it increasingly difficult to get out of bed before dawn. So that's as much as I want to read right now. I love this prose, but I just also really admired, particularly after I read the book and went back and looked at it again, how well this sets the stage for the book, and in particular for Father Christopher's story. You know, it both sort of foregrounds the danger that Sorrow is in. You know, you just feel this uneasiness in this scene. And it's also got to do with his own personal unease that we don't know much about yet. But anyway, I just wonder if you can talk about writing this and also setting the stage sort of in any work to kind of like help the reader get a sense of where we're at the beginning.
Yeah. You writing that particular passage or just...
Whatever rings a bell for you. Yeah.
Rings a bell. Yeah.
Yeah.
the vigil's bell.
Yeah.
Well, I could say writing, you know, in terms of writing that, one of the things that I needed for this book was obviously a lot of research. Not only for, obviously, I'm a white guy who lives in Vermont, or middle-aged white man, writing a third of the book at least, or a half of the book in not the point of view, but from the feeling from within the consciousness of Sarah Abdi-Muz, who is African. She's a young woman. She's a Muslim. She's black. So to do that required a tremendous amount of work, and we could talk about that, but the other thing that took a lot of work was inhabiting a Catholic monk. I'm not Catholic and I'm not a monk. So that was another thing that took, you know, many years. And one of the things I did was visit and stay in monasteries and, you know, have long talks with monks, and I really enjoyed myself doing that. Because it was always a fascination of mine. I mean, not only that I live next to a monastery, but just the idea of monastic living and this idea of closing yourself off to think about or contemplate or pray for the world. I mean, it's what writers do. It's what I think poets do in fiction, or all our artists do. They seal themselves off and write about what's out there, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So I spent a lot of time at Spencer Abbey in Spencer, Mass, the St. Joseph's Abbey, I think it's called, and they're Trappists. And one of the great things is that they have a guest house. They allow people to go on guest retreats there. You pay what you can, and you sort of get to see behind the curtains, in a sense, of like what happens, especially in winter, because I think they... because you don't go outdoors as much. And so you have to, so they take you through the bowels of the monastery, and you're going to get to see what you normally wouldn't see. Anyhow, so that's one of the offices. I mean, that prayer office of vigils is a really powerful, I mean, as anyone who's experienced it or lives it could tell you, the idea of arriving in the dark by candlelight, often, you know, maybe flashlight now, but the idea is that you arrive to the church or the chapel, and it's dark, and you don't see the others, except you see like the shadows of these hooded figures, and, you know, maybe, you know, the altar light, and then out of nowhere in the darkness, as it's maybe getting the slightest bit of blue outside, you hear this unearthly chanting, you know, these voices that just come out of nowhere. And so it's hard not to be moved by that experience. It's kind of a magical moment that happens every morning in the monastery. And then it goes, you know, they have the different prayer offices all day, and then there's one at night, that compline, which is when they sing themselves to sleep, in a sense. You know, they sing the song for bedtime song, and they get a little splash of holy water on them. It's like the little bath before bed. It's... So it's great. So, I mean, that's what comes to mind when I heard you read that scene.
I love that scene. It's wonderful. And I love too that, you know, the very last, and of course it goes on from there, and I almost read another part, but anyway, it goes on from there. Because we learn that he's having a bit of a rough time, even though he lives this lovely existence in this beautiful place with people that he has a mostly really nice rapport with. But he's having a hard time. And so I kind of liked how, even though that's all very beautiful, there's this sense of unease. And he's having difficulty getting out of bed before dawn. So you have, and we've already talked about this, you have three characters who we sort of get to know, maybe not from a direct first-person point of view, but from their storylines. Mm-hmm. Father Christopher Saro, who we've already mentioned, who's the African woman who's trying to go to safety. And then there's Teddy. I wonder, was Teddy a part of the story from the start? I also want to mention that these three people are, this is so interesting to me. So you have Father Christopher, who basically lives in retreat and prays for the world. You have Saro, who's fleeing actual real danger and really trying to find safety in the world. And then you have Teddy, who was a soldier. And so he's seen some of the worst of men. So I loved those three perspectives in this. I wondered if you can talk about Teddy. Also, if you can just sort of talk about finding those three people to put in relationship in different ways.
Yeah. So you asked me if Teddy was always there, and I think he was, even though he gets kind of the short shrift in the book. He doesn't shine, I think, as much as the others, and I had the hardest time writing him, actually, you know, and got him wrong. I mean, just as I got Saro wrong for years, got him wrong too. So they evolved slowly over time, but it seemed important that I needed to have Well, one, I wanted to have somebody who was from Vermont, you know, whose family went back. I mean, a white person whose family went back multiple generations and would be considered a, you know, not a Flatlander, but a Vermonter. And, you know, working class and someone who didn't have a lot of options, like the people that move here, you know, economic options, and who would have been like, you know, a lot of my neighbors would have joined the National Guard and or the army is one way of getting the hell out of the valley. And I mean, partly because these are my neighbors that, I mean, I know a lot of, well, they were not your young men and now they're men who went off to those wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the lucky ones came back. And I know Vermont suffered per capita, like more than any other state in the country in terms of deaths and injuries from those wars. So to put everything into context, just in terms of, you know, the American Imperium and the war on terror and how we were implicated in all that, what was going on in that part of the world, I felt I needed someone or wanted someone that was a Vermonter and yet had been, for no fault of their own, forced to fight a war in the Middle East or the Near East, and experience that. So he has a unique perspective of being both, you know, part of the territory here, because he grew up, Teddy, the fictional Teddy, he grew up on the monastery property with working for his father. Well, his father was the groundskeeper, and Teddy would work as a, you know, high school student, helping him, you know, bush hog the land and mow and stuff like that in the summers and fix the roads. So he had a direct, so he's both from Vermont, but he also knows the perspective of what it's like to be a soldier in Afghanistan and what it's like to be surrounded by these celibate monks that come from all over the place. So he bridges all those worlds.
To some extent, I love just the interrelationship of these three and how their stories come together. I mean, we haven't really said what Teddy does, but Teddy helps Sorrow and kind of brings Sorrow to Christopher, and so that there is this kind of forward momentum in the book. And I liked him as a character. Even I'm sorry you had trouble with him, but I thought you got him in the end.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wanted there to be just some doubt about where his loyalties were going to fall, and I don't know if that came through because I wasn't sure what someone like that would do in his situation.
And that was interesting because you kind of give him another relationship that creates a little bit of conflict for him as well, which I won't go into. I don't want to spoil too much of your book, but.
Right. Yeah.
Let's talk about their names for a minute. I'm always interested in how people come up with character names, and it's not necessarily that deep a question, but you know, it's interesting to me. Christopher has, of course, a famous namesake. Sorrow's name is spelled S-A-H-R-O, but it sounds like Sorrow. And her last name is spelled M-U-S-E, which, is it Muse?
Yeah, Musa or Muse. I think they sometimes pronounce that, yeah.
Okay, so that was interesting to me. I don't know. And then Teddy is a sort of non-threatening name, although, you know, Teddy Roosevelt, you know, big military man. I don't know, were you thinking about these things when you named your characters or not?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I love names. I mean, I love looking, you know, look at Virginia Woolf. She's brilliant at naming people because there's always a hint in the names of something about them. And so I think names are really important. And I mean, obviously Sarah Muse, I mean, yeah, she's my muse, you know, and that's a real Somali name, Musa. And there's also hints of an animal that shows up too, which, so there's a lot of play with that and Fletcher, you know, a Fletcher is someone who puts the feathers on arrows, I think, when you fletch an arrow. So there's little hints. I mean, that's one of the nerdy, geeky novelist thing that you get to do when you spending hours and hours moving words around a page, you know, you could be like, oh, come up with a name. And they do, but they do seem to inform. And Christopher, I tried to give, the problem with Christopher was that I know that my, like a good informant friend is this man who is Father Christopher, and he is a real person. I won't tell you what monastery he's at, but But that name was so resonant for me that I kept on trying to change his name because I didn't want the real Father Christopher to think that I was basing this character on him. But I just couldn't, every time I changed his name, it just kept on coming back to Father Christopher. It just, there was something about it. And so it's an homage, I guess, in a way, to the real Father Christopher.
Yeah. And also, I think there's something to, when you find a name and it does, and it won't change, that's important. I mean, you have to be able to write your story with what feels like a very organic, natural forward momentum, right? And if it feels wrong, that's not a good thing.
Right. I mean, Teddy Fletcher was actually, he had a different name at the beginning. He was named Teddy Skidmore. And I kept on referring to him to Skidmore. And that became really on the nose in terms of the accident. You know, they skidded more off the road. So, and it also was, you know, a name that's in my valley. There's a lot of Skidmores. It's down here, and I don't know if it's in what other parts of New England or what other parts of Vermont, but there's a lot of Skidmores in southwestern Vermont and up and Washington County, and you know, Skidmore College, for instance. It's right over the border, and then. I think I changed that because the fictional monastery, the fictional story takes place somewhere up kind of north in Vermont, kind of in the Northeast Kingdom. I'm not really specific, but somewhere in one of those northern counties. And Skidmore's not a name up there. And so when I was talking to people who lived up there, they're saying, that's like a really weird name. And so I started looking at names that were common to that area of Vermont, and they're very different. And Fletcher was one of them.
Sure. Well, the Fletcher Free Library and the Fletcher Allen Hospital back when it was that.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's not, we don't have that down here. So it's amazing how the regional differences make matter.
You mentioned your research, and you mentioned researching monasteries. Did you talk to people who had taken Sorrow's Journey, or did you mostly read about it, or did you go anywhere? How did you research that?
So in order to write Sorrow, it was a very long process, and I started with, you know, interviewing anyone I could find who was willing to talk to me, who was Somali and who lived in Vermont. And so, and I did find a few people, and I found people in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, who helped me and who read early versions from the Somali community. But I still wasn't really felt like I was getting anywhere, or I wrote an early version or several versions of Sorrow where I just, it just wasn't right. I didn't feel like I knew what I was talking about. And I had a woman read it, Lori Stavron, who worked for the USCRI, the Vermont, what used to be called the Vermont Resettlement Program in Colchester. And she'd been working closely with the Somali community for years up there, and she read it and politely sort of said, "Oh, this Sorrow seems like a very nice literary figure," by which she meant she's a complete fictional version of what a white man would think, and you've got it all wrong because you don't know what you don't know. And most of the things you don't know. And so, and she was willing to kind of help me. And at the same time, you know, this man, Abdi Rashid Hussein, who works at USCRI and who I had interviewed previously, he helped me the most in terms of the journey. Cause he works as a caseworker. And this is what he knows from his years of experience. He knows how people come legally, mostly legally, but he also knows how people seek asylum through other means. And he knew about this journey I had read about it. I had read about it. I'd seen all the movies that were made back in 2012. There were a lot of movies about the La Bestia, the train that the migrant train that mostly people from Central America took. Mexico, but it peppered in with all the people from Central America. There were some Africans, there were Cubans, there were Haitians, there were people from Asia, South Asia. So that stream had been going on, and I was fascinated by it. And I just read everything I could find about it. And there were a lot of things written about it, but it wasn't common knowledge, or it wasn't on the front page of, you know, the Times. And when I, so I, that was the journey that I knew that she would take. But when I went over the details with Abdi Rashid, he was very specific about how it worked. I mean, he knew from people who had come to Vermont, and a lot of them didn't stay in Vermont. But as a lot of immigrants don't always stay in Vermont if this is their first place of resettlement. So that's how I came to understand her story. And it wasn't that I didn't go anywhere. Although I had traveled, in a previous iteration, I'd lived in Central America. And so I knew the landscape somewhat in the same way that I had traveled in the Horn of Africa and knew some of the landscape there when I was younger.
Well, that sounds like a lot more than most people. So.
Yeah. I mean, the interest in Somalia came when I was in the early 90s, and I'd lived briefly in Cairo, and it was the time when Somalia was falling apart or fell apart, and there were all these refugees in Cairo outside the American embassy lining up to try to find a way to get out of, the situation they were in, which is, a situation of homelessness and despair. And so I talked to, people back then and at the embassy and, waved my passport and got sort of like ushered right in while everyone else was out there waiting. And so that left a kind of a deep impression, but wow, that passport, and what it does and who's let in and who's let out, basically, or not let in.
One of your people that wrote a blurb on the back is Uim Akpan, and I did interview him, and there's a scene in his book about trying to get an interview. He makes it very funny.
Yeah, he does.
It's heartbreaking to think about what it must be like and the anxiety people feel in going into these situations and trying to present their best selves and get to get somebody to understand who you are and what you've been through and what you, it's inconceivable, I would imagine, to most Americans to think about that.
Oh, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the writing process. And I hope you don't mind my asking this. I know it's kind of magical and very personal to each author, but I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how you approach a project. How many drafts might you write? I know that this took, from what you've said today, many years to write. Do you research while you're writing? Do you research before you start writing? And it, just whatever comes to mind that might be helpful to listeners who are writers.
Sure. I write many drafts. I mean, I write and rewrite, and it's all in the rewriting. There's years of creation, I think, years of when you just have pages, when you have a blank page and you're just kind of trying to figure out what this ship is that you're building, that is either the most rewarding or the most painful part of it, depending on your temperament or depending on what the day is like. And so you have this, it's almost like you have this mathematical equation, which you can't figure out. And there is no figuring out there's no solution, but you just kind of chew on it all day. And, it's always an impossibility. I think doubt is part of the, is necessary for starting, any project, and doubt in every sense of the word, like, why am I doing this? Why should I publish this? This can't be done. This story doesn't make sense. Who cares? All that stuff is kind of, I think, the necessary kindling. So I think then once you get a shape of it that you're satisfied with, or that it's like, maybe it's, you could put it in the water and it floats, then, that's the exciting part. And when things happen that surprise you is always the exciting part, when you surprise yourself. I mean, as they say, in the craft, no surprise in the writer, no surprise in the reader. So that kind of has to happen. So then it's just drafting and drafting. And then, of course, I'm reading all the time, not other fiction, not other novels, because I try to stay away from other novels while I'm writing one, which is not always possible, but just a lot of things are adjacent to the story or directly related, whether it's you know, about the war in Afghanistan, about Somalia, about, you know, Christian theology, whatever it is. And that's really the fun part for me is the research, because you get to read all this stuff.
I have a suspicion that you don't know the ending as you begin, but what do you know about the arc as you begin? Or maybe it's different with each book.
Yeah. That's interesting. I don't think it's different with each book. I don't really know what's going to happen. I think I have an idea of the shape, like roughly how long a book it's going to be, or maybe that's the closest I come to kind of knowing the form or the shape. But I don't really know where it's going to end. And that's always the tension, I think, that keeps you going and that keeps you awake at night, is that not knowing what's going to happen. And I think it does happen. I mean, your characters really do inform what happens. And I had many different endings for this book that changed over time. Once I got to know who this young woman was, you know, the more I got to know her and the more I got to know about, you know, Somalis who had resettled in Vermont, and the more I got in sort of inside the community, I started to understand her more. So
I'm not going to say what happens at the end of your book, because that's a terrible thing to do. But I will just say that I found that I found it very satisfying to read the book to the end. Although I won't say that I think that absolutely everything was completely resolved, which is interesting. So I liked that.
Yeah. Yeah. It couldn't be resolved because it's not resolved. And in some way, then the novel becomes, you know, a political novel or an activist novel or a novel that's advocacy in a way. Because it's talking about a real situation that's still happening.
Sure.
I mean, there was just an article, I think yesterday, that someone sent me about Roxham Road in New York, and that the Mayor Adams in New York City is sending migrants from New York City to Plattsburgh, New York, and Roxham Road so that they can cross into Canada. And how kind of ironic that is, you know, that here's the Democratic mayor of New York doing exactly what the Republican governors are doing and sending, just kicking the immigrants further north.
So I want to talk about symbols and actual objects or things, and also symbols and what you think as a writer, as far as certain, so I'm thinking, for example, of snow and mm-hmm. apples in your book. They were, just the perfect, you know, in scene, they were the perfect things to be there. On the other hand, I felt like they stood for more than just the things themselves. So I just wonder, do you work to enhance the presence of symbols once maybe they show up, or do you add them in, or what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, no, I think they're integral to the work of an artist, like of a writer or a painter, or, you know, because object—it's all about objects and how you move objects around on a canvas or on the page. And so, this idea of you know, in psychoanalysis, of like transitional objects—you know—that's in a sense a lot of objects can do a lot of work, and they can do a lot of emotional work. And so, I like to think of them as not symbols, because then they become. Then the symbols kind of denaturizes them from what they actually are. They're real things. I mean, an apple's an apple, you know, people eat them, and snow's snow. And then it's a matter of how much resonance you want to imbue them with. So I like the physical world. I like dealing with the physical world and all its, you know, grittiness and stuffness. And then, depending on your mindset, you could take, you know, then you can extrapolate from that. And, you know, you're a reader who sees an apple and, you know, maybe thinks of the Garden of Eden and thinks about Eve, or thinks about, I don't know, any number of things, monasticism, you know, but other readers might just see the apple. So, I mean, I like that it could be taken as anything. And so I think I like doing that in all my work, that it's dealing with the physical world and then just letting it, because objects do have resonance, you know, in the real world, I think. So why not take advantage of that?
The character Edward, who is already gone, he has died before the book begins. But when we are meeting the monastery, meeting the monks, we learn about Edward and what his role was in the monastery and in Christopher's life. I thought it was interesting that you wrote this. Well, I mean, it's not unheard of. Of course, sometimes books talk about characters who are no longer living. But I wondered what kind of special challenges that presents to write about someone who's already gone before the book begins.
I don't know. I didn't think of it as a challenge. I thought of it more like a ghostly presence. He's like the Holy Ghost. Like, he's kind of, and he is, I mean, in some ways he is the unseen hand. I mean, it's his bed that she ends up in, and she ends up in his tunic, and he gives that forward motion to Christopher about what he's mourning, what he's missing, and he also brings in that whole doubt that comes at the end of, you know, a so-called holy life or a devotional life or a life where you've been practicing your whole life for death. I mean, that's really what monks say they do. It's like they're practicing for the next life or practicing for that moment of, as Edward says, you know, graduating upstairs. And so there is a story I heard in the monastery, in one of the monasteries, about something very similar happening with one of the older monks who was cherished and held up as a paragon of the community. And then at the 11th hour, him just saying, oh, this is all bullshit, and all my life has been wasted. And that really was haunting to me, as you know, whatever you think you know about yourself in life at the last minute, and whether it's just the body having a reaction, you know, having like a death throes or.
Right. I mean, didn't Christ have that moment on the cross as well?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's part of, I think that crisis is part of it. And then resolving it. And I think that was the story of this man in the monastery, is that he had that moment that was terrifying to the fellow monks, but then he came to peace with it. And I think maybe that's the story. And it so happened to be that my father was dying at the time that I was writing this. So it was a very personal, it came from a different place too, that to have that experience of the last minutes and watching someone die before you. And it also gave Christopher something to hide from the others, that isolated him as the abbot, because he didn't want to share what happened to this Edward figure. And he was kind of being, in a sense, he was just being selfish. I mean, he realized that through the course of the book, that, well, why did he have to keep that secret? Why didn't he share that with the others?
What are you, let's see. Oh, I know. Have you read any books lately? One or two titles that you might recommend to listeners?
My reading is so weird. I mean, I'm reading this writer, Helene Sissois. I don't even know how to pronounce her name. Sissois, you know, this French feminist from, you know, mid-century. called Interesting Coming to Writing. I mean, that's her. So I'm reading a lot of nonfiction.
Are you reading toward what your next writing is, or?
Yeah, I'm working on something that doesn't really know what it wants to be yet. That it's nonfiction. It's essays that are related to depression and trying to figure out a different story to tell about depression.
Okay, wonderful. Thanks. My last question has to do with advice. Your book It's got conflict, and it actually has antagonists, but it's pretty subtle, and I love that. I mean, there are forces of antagonism. There's something small. There's this small force of like the monks' gossipy, you know, stuff that's going on. But there's also local antagonists who might be trying to keep Sorrow from achieving what she's trying to achieve. And then there's the inner conflict, as I've mentioned before, that's in Christopher, for one. So I wonder if you have advice for introducing conflict in novels and how important you find it to be.
I think part of writing novels or part of writing fiction is just what's the old saw, like putting a character in a situation. I forget who said, you put a character in a situation where they're in conflict with their own heart. I'm paraphrasing someone, and one of your listeners will know probably who I'm paraphrasing, but I forget who said that. I'm also doing disservice to it. But I think it's funny because I think of conflict. I mean, there's so many ways of looking at conflict. There's so many, and in a class, you know, the way you're asking it almost seems like the classical sense of conflict, like a secret or a betrayal or something, like all the usual conflicts that prop up in fiction. But a conflict, yeah, I mean, it could be anything, as you say, you know, it could be someone who is conflicted within himself.
Right. And so maybe rather than offering advice for conflict, just sort of like your take on how important it is or what okay. you look to.
Yeah. So to... I don't think conflict is, I don't see it as something that I've set out to work on, or I don't open a book looking for conflict. In fact, I don't think about it at all. I look at the writing, I look at the prose, I look at the music. And if there's language that's alive on the page, the writer can take me anywhere. I mean, I don't need conflict. I could just be, you know, I could just listen to it like a song or read it like a song. So that's sort of psychological or I guess that sort of plot driven part of fiction doesn't really appeal to me. I know it's kind of necessary for some readers, but I enjoy books where sometimes nothing happens, or nothing ostensibly happens, but the language, the music of the thing, you know, the language of it happens.
That's great. Well, listen, I want to thank you so much for speaking to me today. I want to just mention again, the book is called North, a novel by Brad Kessler, who's my guest today, published by Overlook Press. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you. It's been great.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Vermont author Brad Kessler. You can learn more about his work on his publisher's website, abramsbooks.com. One review of Brad Kessler's work, a blurb by the author Chris Abani, mentions the way that Brad Kessler lets his character's dignity lead the story. I love this observation, and I've been thinking a lot about it. This week's Write the Book prompt is to consider the dignity of your characters, no matter what their goals, obstacles, or plight might be. Consider their dignity as you work to make them real, honest, and not caricatures of good or evil. Keep their dignity in mind as you try to find your way through the story and help them find theirs. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. You may have heard that Write the Book is coming to a close in just a few weeks, but I am still reading all of my email and responding to it. I would love your feedback about the show. I'd love to hear about your experience of being a listener. Let me know if you have upcoming events to announce in the next few weeks. If you like the show, please rate it where you get your podcasts and tell your friends about it. The podcast is going to continue to live at the Podbean app for the foreseeable future. That's at writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all the other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. Hopefully in coming months, you'll see more about my own writing at that website, even though there might be less about the show. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.